Welcome to Exploring Monterey Bay, airing bi-weekly on KSQD 90.7, 89.7, and 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Matilda Rent. My guest is Margie Kahn, author of The Children of the Djinn, In Search of the Kurds and Their Country, and the upcoming publication of Stories from the Heart of Culture. Margie, a linguist, also writes plays and is a musician. Welcome, Margie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on, Matilda.
Now, you mentioned to me that you're living in the linguistic capital of the world. Why do you say that?
Monterey bills itself that way because of the Defense Language Institute, mm-hmm. and it draws all those teachers from who speak languages from all over the world, and a lot of them stay. So it has a very international flavor that I find very congenial.
In linguistics, you have an early start in that yourself.
Yeah, I majored in it, and then I got graduate degrees in it. And, you know, I had professors in grad school who were trained at DLI, even. They were there during the war, you know, So that's how they got into linguistics.
Now, what about French in third grade?
Yeah, right. French in third grade was just my own idea, right? Yeah, I somehow had this idea that I needed to learn foreign languages, even in North Jersey, where people were just speaking English, as far as I knew.
And so from then on, you got the linguistic bug and you went to study?
I did. Well, I worked on French and then I was a nanny in Europe for this couple. And we went to Scandinavia and I thought I'd jump start it by learning Danish on my own. But I found learning Danish very difficult. If anybody out there, if you know Danish, it kind of is written like German and Swedish, but all the consonants are swallowed. It all becomes glottal stop. And if you don't know phonetics, it's very hard.
Wow.
So after that, I was like, I think I need some more information.
You have a mixed background yourself?
Culturally, I have a mixed background, but people wouldn't really think it that so mixed. But in terms of family, yeah, my families were very different. And my mother was descended from people here before the revolution. And my father was descended from people who came from Russia and the Baltic states. They were Jews, and so my two families were really different in terms culturally, but language-wise, they spoke the same language, sort of.
English.
Yeah.
You went to which university? Michigan?
Yeah, I went to undergrad in New York City, and then I went to University of Michigan to grad school, yeah.
And so how did you end up in this Middle Eastern language thing?
Well, I was interested in Middle East language. I studied Turkish as an undergraduate. I had to take a non-Indo-European language to major in linguistics. And I knew a lot of Turks in New York, believe it or not. And I got very interested in Turkish, which is very different from English. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to grad school, it seemed like a natural thing to start studying Arabic. And so I did. And Michigan had a really good Arabic program, a really good Middle East language department. And so I got heavily into Arabic. But then I found out about Kurdish, and unlike Arabic has a lot of scholars. When I found out about Kurdish, I thought, well, here is a language that actually needs to be studied. Kurdish is the fourth language of the Middle East.
It is?
Yeah.
But which are the first three?
Well, the first is Arabic. And I don't know, probably the second is Turkish or Turkic languages. Mm-hmm. And the third is probably Persian or things related to Persian.
Right.
And then Kurdish. Kurdish and Persian are actually related, though. They're both Indo-Iranian languages.
You got into Arabic. How come you didn't stick with it?
A lot of people who were studying Arabic, like their parents spoke it. You know, they were in Michigan. A lot of people in Michigan speak Arabic. I wanted to do field work also, and I didn't see myself needing to do field work in Arabic, whereas Kurdish, a lot of people hadn't even gone into the field and collected the language, which is what I wanted to do. And I studied at Michigan with some interesting people. They were linguistic missionaries from the Summer Institute of Linguistics, and they went places and they wrote the Bible in those languages. I mean, they developed writing systems for those languages. Kenneth Pike, who founded the Summer Institute of Linguistics, and they were also very good linguists. I was kind of inspired by them. So I wanted to go to a place where my work as a linguist, I wasn't into being a missionary, but I was into the idea of working with people who appreciated that I was there. And that was the way the Kurds were. They were very appreciative that I was there studying their language, yeah.
Then you went studying the Kurds. Obviously, you had to go to the Middle East. Where did you go?
My idea was originally to go to Turkey, and In Turkey, Kurdish is pretty much an outlawed language. And I didn't think I was going to get very far. That was confirmed for me. So there was a teacher of Turkish at Michigan who knew about this agricultural college up near the Iranian and Iraqi borders that a friend of hers was working at, and they needed English teachers. So we went there as English teachers. And that was useful because I never would have gotten permission from the Iranian government to be there. So it was pretty much clandestine field work. So I taught English at this little agricultural college up in northwest Iran. The city that I was in was originally a Christian city, Aramaic-speaking. In Aramaic, if you want to know all these little linguistic factoids, Aramaic was actually the language of Christ. And Aramaic was spoken by the Christians and the Jews there. There were 50 Jewish families. There were Christians there. They didn't speak of their language as being the same language, but it was the same language. And everybody was in their little bailiwick there. The Armenians, the Assyrians, they were both Christian. And the city was mostly run by Turkic speakers. And around the city were Kurdish villagers. And that's where I had to find the book that I wrote, that I ended up writing, which is not a academic book, but it's really a story of how I managed to do this fieldwork. And at first, I had a very hard time because I couldn't find Kurdish speakers in the city, and I couldn't find, even at the college where I taught, they were speaking a different dialect. There are two major dialect divisions in Kurdish, and the one that's spoken in Turkey, the northern Kurdish, wasn't, the people at the college, they mostly spoke southern. I was always trying to find speakers, and one day I had this wonderful shortwave radio. I turned on my radio, got an FM station locally that was broadcasting in the very dialect that I wanted to learn.
Oh my gosh.
So it was another radio connection. I have a lot of radio connections in my life. So my father actually was a radio operator during World War II, the Yukon. So I was introduced to radio young, and I heard this programs, and I have to go find the radio station. So I did. And those were my first Kurdish teachers, the guys at the radio station.
And it was like in a little place. It was not in a big building, I assume.
No, it wasn't a big building. Of course, they were broadcasting various kinds of propaganda, but they were also doing a lot of local music, and they were doing poetry, and they were interesting guys. Yeah, there were four of them.
So you have a lot of stories from your year. It was a year of field work.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting to me is that the Kurds are spread out over several different countries.
Correct.
It really doesn't have its own country.
They don't have their own country. They were supposed to have their own country at the end of World War I with the Treaty of Sevres. It just was washed away. And the Armenians didn't get their own country either. It's the largest ethnic group, I believe, that doesn't have its own country. Yeah.
But you familiarized yourself with where they were, you went where they were, and you learned a lot, and you came up with this book called The Children of the Djinn.
It's the story of my search for the Kurds, yeah.
Tell me one anecdote that really stood out for you when you started searching for them.
I went to the radio station, and it was awkward in many ways, but there was a courtyard that I always used to pass with this very sort of picturesque courtyard. And I would see these guys, and the men were dressed in Kurdish clothing. They wore baggy trousers and fitted jackets, and they had turbans on. And I just always wanted to meet those people in the courtyard. And so my connections to people were through the radio station, and it turned out finally that those guys at the radio station, they waited to see if they were going to trust me, because nobody really trusted anybody in the Shah's Iran, and especially people coming and saying they were studying Kurdish. And finally, this guy took me out to several villages, but he finally introduced me to the people from that courtyard. And the guy is one of the major characters. These are people that I came to know well. He had been part of Barzani's group in Iraq, fighting for Kurdish independence for years. Mm-hmm. And they had been invited to Russia. And he had lived in Russia and gotten a PhD in Leningrad. Long story. But I met him and his wife and became quite good friends with them. And they're in the book, and they're just some just amazing people that I met.
You're mostly in Iran, right?
I was living in northwest Iran, and I was based there. As far as Greater Kurdistan goes, because you talk about Greater Kurdistan, there were Kurds from Iraq coming to the city where I was as refugees. So the year that I was there is a very remarkable year that I happened to be there. Mm-hmm. It was the year that the United States CIA backed the Kurds to rise up against Saddam Hussein. And the reason why they backed the Kurds, they did it at the Shah's bidding, because the Shah wanted to harass Saddam Hussein in order to get this disputed territory back from the Shah al-Arab in southern Iran. And so the CIA came in and said, we're going to back your insurrection. And there were actually American Army experts there in the town where we were. And there was bombing that overshot the border. There was bombing that overshot and went into Iran that happened during that year, too.
Was it 1979?
So that was 1974 to 75. Okay. And if any of you in the listening audience here remember this, there was a Pike Committee report about the doings of the CIA, some of these foreign adventures. Kissinger's famous quote was, it's not missionary work. And it certainly wasn't. They sold out the Kurds. Basically, the Shah came to an agreement to get the territory back. And then it was fought over again with the Iran-Iraq war. The Kurds pretty much just lost out totally. There were 100,000 refugees in the town where I was. And there were refugee schools, and I actually had volunteered in the schools. So they said, you can't fight anymore, even though you want your rights in northern Iraq. We don't have any more use for you. You're finished. People were just glad that there wasn't any more fighting, but the Kurds who went back, Saddam Hussein punished all of them, and so it was really wiser not to go back. But this is all written up in my book, a documentary of what U.S. foreign policy kind of resulted in.
And the Kurds got shafted.
They totally did. And then as far as the Kurds in Turkey, I was completely right in thinking I couldn't have gone to Turkey. There was a little reception where I met the Turkish consul of the city where I was in, and I actually told him, he said, oh, you know, so nice you Americans are here. And I said, yes, but I would have really liked to be in Turkey learning Kurdish. And this guy looked at me, his eyes bugged out, and he said, we have no such institutes in Turkey. But then I did go to Turkey. I did actually go over the border because I really wanted to experience it. That was the dialect that I was particularly interested in. Mm-hmm.
Listeners, you are in luck. We have a wonderful talk with Margie Khan, my guest for today. She is the author of The Children of the Yin, In Search of the Kurds and Their Country, and Stories from the Heart of Culture. Besides that, she writes plays and is a musician and has many other artistic inklings. Tell me a little bit more about how you established friendship. She said a little bit. And how is that reflected in your book and your stories? You're there by yourself, or were you there with a group?
I was there with my first husband, and it would not have been safe for me to go there by myself. I can tell you that. How I established friendships was over a period of time winning people's trust. Mm-hmm. My field is the sound of language, phonetics, and phonology, and I had a really nice portable reel-to-reel tape recorder, but I held off recording, and I just would go and have tea with these women. And finally, the winter was ended, and the winter is very harsh in the villages with a lot of snow, and I got invited out to the village. And did I even have my tape recorder then? I don't think so. This guy showed up in our town from UCLA, Yonah Sabar, who was working on Aramaic, Assyrian, also called Assyrian, and he just showed up with this video camera. I couldn't believe it, in the village. And I'm like, I haven't even taken out my tape recorder, and he's got his video camera. The nerve of it. But Yonah was shameless, you know. So we went to the village, but gradually I did start taping people. I tried to record people talking about their lives because I was very inspired by William LaBeouf's approach of doing field work, which is you ask people about things that are really close to them and they don't think about how they talk, because I wanted to get really natural speech. And two of the ways that he did that was asking people the time they came closest to death, or asking the prophetic dreams. Well, asking people in a part of the world where people were routinely tortured about the time they came closest to death was really not that smart. And so I had to abandon that really quickly. And the prophetic dreams, I remember somebody did tell me some prophetic dreams, but mostly what I ended up recording were folktales. So I collected quite a few folktales.
That's wonderful.
And it was alive art. In the villages, a lot of these villages were remote enough, they didn't even get radio. So they actually were still telling each other stories and just singing at weddings. And that was their entertainment. I was really privileged to be here, to be there at a time when it was like that.
Well, it's interesting that you say here. I mean, I see you as if you're there. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. You brought something to read from the Children of the Yin? Listeners, of course, this is 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM, and online, ksqd.org. This is Exploring Monterey Bay on KSQD.
So this is an excerpt from Children of the Gin from the middle of the book when I went over the border to Turkey. Even though Turkey was right there over the Zagros Mountains, it turned out to be quite a long and difficult journey just to get over the border. And we couldn't get much information. The U.S. Army ended up giving us rides because we couldn't get rides even from the local taxis. And we went over the border and we went to the nearest town, which was named Yüksekova. And we thought we were going to get the bus to Van, which was the closest city in eastern Turkey to Iran. And we got to the bus station, and this is what happened. I stepped over to the low wooden table that served as a counter. Behind the table sat a tall, handsome man with curly red hair and a red mustache. His blue eyes twinkled as he watched me get out the necessary Kurdish. "We want to buy tickets to Van," I began. The red-haired man gazed briefly out the window. The rest of the males present watched the ensuing interaction closely. "You are too late," he told me. "The bus is gone for the day." I looked at my watch. It was not yet 10 o'clock, and our American friend had told us the bus from Yüksekova to Van didn't leave until 11. "It couldn't have left. It's too early," I said. "Yes, but it is gone," he told me, looking pleased. I glanced behind me where my husband was standing by our suitcases, straining to understand what was going on. The red-haired man added in response to my anxious look, "What is your hurry? You must stay and see our town." I translated this to my husband, who was looking apprehensive and uncomfortable. He was not used to being incommunicado. In Iran, nearly all the Kurds we met knew some Persian, but now, since he knew neither Kurdish nor Turkish, he was left out in the cold. The audience soon sensed this fact, and the men were intrigued by it. "Who is he?" asked the red-haired man, gesturing toward him. "My husband," I answered. "He doesn't speak Kurdish. Why do you hang around with him?" If I hadn't been in eastern Turkey, I might have enjoyed this turnabout from the time my husband had been offered another wife. But here in Yüksekova, I was in no position to laugh. I was very glad he was here with me, and I didn't want these men to think otherwise. I had heard that two American women who went over the Iranian-Turkish border alone in their car were gang raped. I scanned the walls and table of the bus station for any schedule that might tell me when the bus really left. Then I asked the red-haired man again, but he kept assuring me that the bus left at 8 o'clock that morning, and that if I would only stop worrying, I could spend the night in Yüksekova and get the bus the next day. I think I'll stop there. So
you leave us in suspense.
If you want to find out what happens, you have to get the book.
Then you have to get the book. You studied linguistics and many other fields, and then you had a number of jobs. Now, which of the jobs that you held was of most interest to you?
I had a couple of fun jobs. One was I worked at an agency that helped blind people use computers, and I worked on assistive technology as part of that job. And I had a background in computer speech recognition and synthesis, soft voice, so I knew something about the technology that people use to get computers to speak. I worked on early speech recognition, but I worked in Silicon Valley. Those weren't very interesting jobs. The interesting jobs were the jobs that applied the information. That was interesting.
You taught in Egypt also?
Yeah, I had a job teaching at Alexandria University in Egypt.
Doing what in Egypt?
I was teaching Arabic phonetics, believe it or not. But I was teaching in English, luckily. The linguistic ability of Egyptians is really phenomenal. Being in Egypt was almost like being in Europe compared to being in Iran.
That is interesting. And then you came here and you have a volunteer program out of an adult school. What's that?
Partners in Learning. I basically had a program where we brought in community volunteers to help with the ESL classes, which were huge and mostly dealing with undocumented immigrants.
Yeah. English as a second language classes.
Yeah. With a lot of people who hadn't even had any kind of formal education.
But that's heartwarming when you get people excited about learning, right?
The people in my class all wanted to be there.
Yeah,
that was really nice.
And you also worked with people who were blind and visually impaired?
Well, that's the job at Sensory Access Foundation that I mentioned before, yeah.
Okay.
Where I evaluated the kinds of equipment, assistive technology that people use, where you get the computer screen to speak out to you. The personal computer revolutionized the lives of blind people. because it made it possible for people to access information that they hadn't been able to. But then the graphical user interface was created a big block. So anyway, it's a long story, but that was pretty exciting. I actually went to three different conferences at Asilomar, and I knew I had to move to the Monterey Bay area.
Right. Well, we're fortunate that you're here. I can imagine you studied a lot of different languages and you experienced many different cultures during your travels. Did it make it harder for you to be again in the U.S.?
No, because America is my home. I am American. There were a lot of things that were hard about living in the Middle East, one of them being a woman. I mean, not that it isn't hard here in some ways, but I think it enriched my life tremendously in terms of having those connections and being able to draw on them. I mean, I run into lots of people in Monterey who speak Middle East languages. Mm-hmm. Kind of neat.
That is nice.
Yeah.
Would you think that you changed?
Oh, I totally changed from having had that experience. And one of the big early lessons for me, I mean, I was in my 20s, to experience American foreign policy in the Middle East firsthand, that really changed me.
Listeners, if you want more information about Margie Kahn's book and her writings, so the book is called Children of the Yin, and she read something. It's about the Kurds and their country, and it's a personal story. And I think you did it on purpose because I think it makes it more real for people when they hear you trying to find the Kurds.
Oh, yeah. Well, I tried to make it really honest and talk about the mistakes I made. And it's Children of the Jinn. The word Jinn, J-I-N-N, is related to our word genie, invisible spirits.
Yeah. See, another little important thing to know here. So you also wrote articles on phonetics and phonology, and they appeared in a number of academic journals. And then your short stories have been published in literary journals and popular magazines. And then, of course, your plays have been produced at theaters in California and Maryland. Anything else that you think people need to know about?
No, thank you for listening. And I hope the people who are listening are interested in finding out more about the Kurds because they're still there, even if they don't figure in the news as much lately.
And they don't have a country.
Right.
And they're spread out over several different countries.
Right.
And some of them are more sympathetic than others. The Turks, obviously not.
The Turks want to erase any other culture besides Turkic culture.
Yeah.
It's really a problem.
That is a problem. And then Iran was somewhat more empathetic.
Well, Iran, when I was there, it wasn't such a big deal, but the Iranian government now sees the Kurds as much more of a threat. And of course, Gina Amini, you know, the young woman who was killed in Iran, she's Kurdish. And they see their Kurds as a much bigger threat than they used to.
What about Iraq?
Well, Iraq, we have the no-fly zone of northern Iraq, so the Kurds are probably the safest. But I was thinking about this, about culture. There are other ways to kill culture, and shopping malls can do it. Mm-hmm. Northern Iraq has become more like that, the danger of the 21st century and social media and shopping malls. And then there's war, and what happened to Kurds in Syria, and what happened to the Yazidi Kurds with ISIS. So the threats are just everywhere. And in terms of our cultural diversity in the world is definitely under threat.
Yeah. Now, you have a website called Pearl Note Press, P-E-A-R-L. N-O-T-E Press, pearlnotepress.com. And you, listeners, you can get more information. And I loved going through your website.
Oh, thank you.
So I highly recommend people do that. So again, you've been listening to Exploring Monterey Bay. Matilda Rand here, the host, and Margie Kahn, author of Children of the Jinn, and the upcoming book, Stories from the Heart of Culture, and Pearl Note Press. And I really enjoyed having you enlighten me a little bit more. I've always been interested in the Kurds. That's why I asked you on this program. I'm not sure why, but I always thought that they were not respected
right. In
the world. There's other ethnic groups that the same thing happened to them.
Right.
But I really appreciate that you have connected with them, wrote a book that we now can read, that you were willing to come on my program.
Oh, thank you so much, Matilda. Yes, the Kurds have given me a lot. I feel very lucky to have
that. I hear that, and I see that.
Yeah.
If listeners, if you could see her face, it lights up. So thank you so much, and I'm going to hand it back to Damien, our wonderful engineer.
Thank you, Damien.